Hi there, I'm Corey Raven, and welcome to Crosstalk Podcasts, where we do our part to inspire recovery from addiction and discover a better way. Whether you're considering a life free from substance use dependency, or you're already on that path, Crosstalk is here for you. Each episode, we do a deep dive into the experiences and stories of people who have walked the walk of recovery, alongside experts in the field to enhance our understanding. Our mission is simple: to help you navigate the challenges and celebrate the victories of your personal journey to a better life. So buckle up and let's hit the road as we embark on this transformative journey together. This is Crosstalk Podcasts, and I want to welcome a terrific guest that we have today. You won't believe what we are about to hear. Really cool story. Heidi P. is here with us today. Heidi, welcome to Crosstalk.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. The way we start off is to just tell our listeners a little bit about how things started out in Heidi's life and where you grew up and what that was like.
I grew up in upstate New York, what people would call like a normal family. My parents were married. I have one younger brother. Nothing was abnormal. My parents don't use, they don't smoke cigarettes, nothing like that. I was really good in school. I think things took a little bit of a turn when my parents got divorced. Middle school time, my friends changed a little bit. And
so eighth grade, seventh grade?
Yeah, seventh and eighth grade, middle school.
Was the divorce a amicable divorce, or was it a lot of fighting going on?
It was nasty. Me and my brother got to see sides of my parents that were complete opposite of what we kind of grew up knowing. My dad decided to go be with somebody else, and me, my brother, and my mom went and lived in a hotel for a little while. And that's kind of when I started partying too. My friends that were in my high school would go to the hotels on the weekends and party, and they didn't know that I lived there. So I kind of, you know, joined that group.
Was that a good thing, or was it embarrassing, or how did that play out with your friends?
I didn't tell them that I was living in the hotel. Like, they were just my party friends. So honestly, none of them really cared. They didn't really care what I was doing in my personal life. We'd meet up, use. That's when I first started smoking weed. I started skipping school a lot. I think my brother was a little bit younger, so my mom was focused on my brother. My dad kind of took a step back. We didn't really talk to my dad for a while. And I was just running around with my friends, and I don't really think my mom thought I was like getting into the trouble that I was getting in. She more or less was focused on kind of rebuilding her own life, taking care of my brother and letting me do my thing. And my thing wasn't that great.
How much of what you were doing were you overtly trying to hide, or were you any kind of reaching out for help, or you just didn't want her involved at all? You were thrilled that she was focused on your brother.
No, she would question me and stuff. I would come back smelling like either weed or cigarettes and stuff. And my mom, she picks up on that stuff right away. She's not like blind. So her questioning me and things like that, she did end up reaching out to my dad, concerned that I was like, you know, I wouldn't listen to her regardless. She was telling me, I don't think you should be hanging out with these people. What are you doing? And I was not reaching out for help. I was having fun. I don't know. At that point, I didn't really care. I didn't see it as an addiction. I didn't see it as a problem. I just saw it as I'd rather be spending all my time with my friends. And that's how it went on for for a while, up into high school. And then smoking weed turned into like doing cocaine once in a while because everybody else was doing it.
So what kind of a feeling did you get from the transition from being kind of a good girl, mm-hmm, to smoking weed and then experimenting with other things? Did you get more comfortable with a lot of the trauma that was going on at home? Did it feel like you needed that as a way to cope with everything?
Yeah, it made me feel like I didn't really care what was going on at home. And then it made me feel like, you know, with my party friends and stuff, I was always one too that like I was smoking the most, or I was doing the most. Like, I don't want to say it was like idolized, but in my head, it was like I belonged with people that were accepting me. And then on top of that, it was like they were egging it on. Like, I knew what I was doing was wrong, but in my eyes, it was like I was winning at that time. Like, I didn't really see it as any sort of issue.
How about the financial side of it? Where'd you get the money from to do this stuff?
I was stealing it. from my, whether it was, you know, my mom's purse. I started breaking into my dad's house, things like that. I think I was 15 years old. I got caught for shoplifting from Walmart. Stupid. I didn't have my own money. So, and I had like no remorse for it at the time. It was like, oh, it's nothing to take $60 out of my mom's wallet.
Any consequences from any of those things?
My mom and dad both didn't want me at their home. They were like, you know, go live with your friends if that's the case. Other than that, not really, you know, I wasn't around them too much. I was kind of just running off and doing my, my own thing until my mom one day, she ended up getting an apartment. We got out of the hotel. And I was getting ready to go out with friends, and I had some weed and cocaine in my purse, and I left my purse in my bedroom. I went to use the bathroom and then went, grabbed my purse and left. My friend picked me up, and we weren't even halfway down the road, and she's like, break out a line. So I went to go do that, and it was gone. And I was like, turn the car around. And I went home. My mom had it on the table, and she's like, I called your dad, and you're never allowed here ever again. He's coming to get you. And I was like super pissed because...
You were angry. You weren't remorseful or anything like that.
No.
She had interrupted what you were going to do, and it was none of her business.
Yeah. And then I was really mad that she called my dad, just because since their divorce, he hadn't really been a part of my life.
And what happened? Did he arrive and you were there?
Yep. So that was like a switch in my life. My mom kind of wiped her hands of me for a long time. We didn't talk. I never, my brother stayed with her, and my dad literally came in the house and threw me over his shoulder and threw me in the truck.
How old were you?
15 at this point, 15, 16, if that.
Dad is a big guy?
Bigger than me. And he was pissed. My dad's very like traditional black and white. He's a farmer. Like my dad is just very black and white. So he wasn't too happy under those circumstances to come and get me.
What was the impact of all those events on you? Did you have to make a change, or did you just have to do better at hiding things?
The right answer would be make a change. In my head, it was, I just kept wanting to fight it. I hated everybody. I hated my parents. I hated the world. I just wanted, in my head too, it was like, all my friends are doing this. Like, leave me the hell alone. So the more that they tried to control it, the more out of control I became. I just didn't care.
And did there come a point where you left your mom and dad? Did you were on your own entirely?
Not for a while. My dad rode this out with me for a long time. I created a lot of problems. He took me into his house after that. And like I said, my mom had literally no contact with me.
He was with another woman.
Yeah. My dad, he was with another woman at the time. He was with somebody before him and my mom were actually engaged. And the minute that I moved into the house, I walked downstairs and I heard her talking to my dad. And she says, it's either me or her talking about me. And she left her engagement ring on the counter and left. So I think there's some resentments that my dad still holds, because there's a couple failed relationships that he's had because he felt where he needed to prioritize me. And it just kind of severed some things.
You know, with a sober brain, we'll find out. Mm-hmm. You have a sober brain going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think that your dad's a pretty good guy, having prioritized you over, you know, his interests in other women.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see that at the time, or did you all you would do? Were you just angry?
I saw it a little bit. I was still angry at him because of just the dynamic of that, like the way he hurt my mom, the way that they separated. The fact that, you know, me and him weren't really that close. My whole upbringing, my mom was a stay-at-home mom and he worked on the farm. So it's like, here I am living in a house with him, and I felt like I didn't even really
know.
We had to kind of build a relationship, and being at where I was at in life, what kind of relationship are we really going to have?
Dad's alive?
Yes, very much so.
Does he know that that's something that you appreciate? Or you, that even though you weren't able to say it then, you have a good relationship with him now?
Our relationship, we're still working on it. Me and my dad have been through a lot. Just recently I moved back to New York. So me and my daughters are living with him temporarily until I find my own place. And a lot of stuff has happened in the past. So now, like when I was living in Wisconsin, it was a little bit easier because we weren't around each other 24/7. Now that we're kind of back living together, we kind of have to, you know, it's a different dynamic that we're working towards. But overall, it's good.
That's good. That's good. Mm-hmm. So you're living with your dad. You're accelerating your drug use. When you got out of high school, what'd you do after that?
high school continued to be a mess between my drinking and partying. When I was living with my dad, he put me on pins, what they call like juvenile probation. So because he couldn't control me, he kind of like turned me in and thought maybe the state would give me some rules and regulations and I would listen, and I didn't. Like they put me on house arrest. I cut the band off, took my dad's truck on a school night, went down the road, got drunk with friends and wrapped it around a telephone pole, parked it back in the driveway and left. So he woke up for work and his whole truck was totaled. Just like out of control behavior. And they all throughout high school, they tried to, you know, like I said, control it. I went to Wilderness Boot Camp. That was my senior year.
How many days did you spend at Wilderness?
I was there for 97 days total. That was May 23rd, 2011. I got escorted out of my house.
Now, before we started this broadcast, you told me that the Wilderness program was worse than
jail.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So tell everybody why Wilderness was so bad.
It caught me by surprise. First of all, this is something my dad had in the making without me knowing. So like I said, I woke up in the middle of the night to two strangers that ripped me out of my bed. He had a what they call an escort service come and get you. I knew nothing about where I was going or anything. I just had to go with them. Later, I found out that I was in the Adirondacks. So it's called Adirondack Leadership Expeditions. There was me and about eight other girls in this group. And it is like, they call it behavioral therapy boot camp. So it's all kind of military style. They call you by a number, not your name. And you are outside in the elements 24/7.
So the idea was to give you some structure and get you away from drugs and alcohol.
Correct. Yeah. It's for, it's like a dual purpose. So it's girls that were struggling with addiction, self-destructive behaviors, anorexia, bulimia. It's supposed to be like an overall self-improvement boot camp. They combine like therapeutic skills. So you have a counselor that comes out once a week, talks to you and gives you new skills to work on. And then the other is like the wilderness part where you're setting traps and hiking mountains and doing ridiculous stuff.
So you got out of that program.
Yes.
You must have been pretty angry.
I was pissed, yeah.
And what did you do after you got out of the program? Did you act out?
For a very short time, I went back to dad's, and as it was more of out of fear of going back, getting sent back to that place, that I tried to, you know, make changes. But it was very hard. I was right back into the environment. Like my dad's house, I don't really know how to explain it, because like I said, he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, but the dynamic there has always been very unhealthy for me. So once I went right back to that, it was like I stayed clean for a short time, but I didn't have other resources to kind of start building a life outside of that. I didn't have a car or a license. I don't live in an area where it's able, where I'm able to like walk to and from a job. So it's like I went back and planted my butt right back in my dad's house. And it was only a matter of time before the same lifestyle came right back in and I started doing the same exact thing.
So what phase did you enter at that point?
I gradually worked myself into doing heroin.
Shooting?
Yeah. At first it was sniffing it. And there was like my party friends in high school. And then there was a small group off of that started to do the hard drugs. And that's the group I kind of gravitated towards. And I remember the first bag that I got, I sniffed it and everybody else was already shooting it. And I was like, I don't do needles. Like that's never going to be me. And, you know, I've used drugs and alcohol obviously before, but I've never experienced withdrawals. I've been hungover and felt like crap, but you know, they make it very apparent, or you have the knowledge that if you're going to dip your toes into this, like, you know, the potential consequences, and it still didn't faze me. So for a short time I was sniffing it. And then because of the fact that I didn't have money like that.
What year are we talking about when you started doing that?
So this is probably going to be 2013. It was right after, a little bit after high school.
Was it pre-fentanyl?
Yeah. Yeah.
You think if you know, you were born 5 or 10 years later, you probably wouldn't have had as good a result as you have now.
Definitely.
So you're doing heroin, and was that the worst stuff that you did, or was it a gateway to other things as well?
It was definitely a gateway to other things. It switched up a little bit. The heroin I struggled with for a while, I started to obviously withdraw very shortly after I started sniffing it. I remember I woke up at my friend's house and she was already shooting it. And I woke up and I felt like I had a cold. I was like, man, I don't feel good. And she's like, here, do this. I was like, I don't want that. I don't feel good. She's like, do it. And I did it and I instantly felt better. And I remember sitting there being like, oh, fuck. Like, this is...
You're addicted.
Yeah, I was like, oh, no. So I, like, it wasn't enough to stop. But then shortly after that, like I said, with the fact that I couldn't financially support myself, I was only getting one or two bags at a time. Everybody else is getting a bundle. So I was hanging out with friends one day and I was like, I just sniffed my one bag that I had and I was like, it's not doing anything. I'm still sick. He's like, well, no shit. You're doing it the wrong way. And he's like, here, and offered to shoot me up. And I didn't even hesitate in that moment. And then I quickly reflected back on the fact that I was like, I couldn't even believe I like somebody put a needle in my arm. And after that, it's like, once you put a needle in your arm, you don't go back to doing it the other way. And that's kind of started a whole downhill spiral with how I continued to use drugs from then on out. It was always putting something in a needle.
Physically, you must have become unwell because that's probably the you know, a natural consequence of shooting up.
Yeah, for a while. I was still living with my dad and I overdosed a few times. He brought me, I can't even tell you, this whole time I'm on probation, by the way. I'm still somehow magically getting around drug screens. My dad's telling my probation officer I'm using.
No jail time.
Oh, no jail time yet. Nope. I snuck under the radar.
And how old are you at this point?
18.
Wow.
Yeah. Continue to do heroin. I went to several 30-day programs, inpatient rehabs, and then a few detox centers. All of which my dad, you know, put me in. And then it's 2016, it was, when I ended up finally, it caught up to me. So I was stealing literally everything in my dad's house. We have the family farm, and I would ask him, like, can I do something for work for money? And he was like, absolutely not, because you're going to buy drugs and cigarettes with it. So I'd be like, okay, then. Well, then I'm going to take your TV off the wall. Like, I was robbing him blind.
Were there criminal repercussions from that?
There was this time around. Yeah, slowly but surely, he knew his belongings were missing and he'd flip out, but I don't think he had the heart to ever do anything about it. And, you know, he'd go into these episodes where he'd be like, get the hell out of my house. And I'd be at friends' houses for a little bit. And then he'd let me come back one day and like eat and stay the night or something. It was just chaos that I brought to his house. And then one day, a friend of his went into the pawn shop, I guess. I don't know if it was convenience or whatever, bad luck on my part, but it happened. And he called my dad and he goes, Bobby, half of your house is in this pawn shop. My dad has like custom, you know, electric guitars and snow cross equipment, like expensive stuff. His friend recognized it. And my dad had to go back to the pawn shop and buy it all back. And in the meantime, I raided his house and took all like a couple grand out of his safe and left. So after he went to the pawn shop to buy all of his stuff back, came back to the house to get the money out of the safe to repay his friend that just had to cover the major expenses of paying for
it. No money there.
There was no money there. He pressed charges on me. I didn't know that. So I'm on probation. He called the police. And that same exact day, I was with a friend of mine who was on parole. Me and her were in the car and we just got stuff. We ended up shooting it up, did it. And an undercover cop pulls us both out of the car. And they were watching one of us. I don't know, but we both got arrested. Called my dad from the jail. And I was like, I don't think I'm getting out of here because I'm on paper. We just got a possession charge. And surprisingly, they booked us in and let us go. But I knew as soon as my probation agent was notified I'd been arrested, I was going right back in. So I left the jail. I went home to my dad's house, fell asleep. Police came to pick me up. And that's when I found out he pressed charges because they didn't come for the drug charge. They came because my dad pressed charges on the larceny stuff. So that's when I went to jail.
How long did you go to jail for?
A little over a year.
How was that experience?
Definitely life-changing. I still didn't, when they picked me up and booked me into the jail, I found out that I was there for my dad's stuff too. So that pissed me off. And I thought that he was trying to prove a point. So out of all the things I've done, the crashing the truck, the drug use, whatever, I snuck under the radar. I've never been to jail. So I thought it was going to be like still a slap on the wrist. I didn't see any severity in it. I was like, okay, they put me here to learn a lesson. Like, you don't like it here. And then let me go. And that was not the case. They were like, you got to wait to see a judge. I waited over a week to see one. And then I was like insistent on the fact that they were going to be like, oh, you can go home. And that was not the case.
What did the judge tell you?
I'll never forget it. I went before this judge for when I crashed my dad's truck and stuff. I had fines to pay and I had no job. So this judge, I was going in front of this judge every Tuesday for traffic court and making a payment. He's like, I don't care if you come here and give me a dollar. I want to see like consistency from you. So this judge was very familiar with me. Had a stand in front of him and I was on probation still. And I told him, you know, in 2014 is when I had my daughter. So he knew I also had a child. And I stood in front of him and said, you know, I can't go to jail. And he's like, oh, I'm going to max sentence you on these charges and I'm going to take you off probation because you don't know how to listen. So he goes, you're of no good use to your daughter right now, Miss Pulowski. Enjoy your year stay at the Oneida County Jail. And I just about wanted to flip out. I was like,
you couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Nope. And he goes, your time starts now. So the week and a half I sat before even seeing him didn't count at all. And I literally thought I was going to die. I thought it was the end of the world. And at that moment for me, it kind of was.
Looking back, was it a good thing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And it was a good thing because why?
There was still good to come out of it. It taught me, well, first of all, I was clean in there. So, I mean, that's one way to do it, I guess. Made me appreciate certain things. You know, a year is a lot of time that I didn't want to waste, but I watched a lot of girls, some very close to age with me, have children, and they're going to be going to prison for a long time. You know, I watched a lot of other people come in and out of there making mistakes that could have easily been me. So it made me almost appreciate my year. You know, I wasn't going to prison. I'm going to get back out and have a chance to watch my daughter grow up. I learned a lot in there.
In terms of what things it gave you some perspective on, being able to be a mom to your child.
Absolutely.
Was one of them. Any other things you can think of that it helped you gain some enlightenment on?
I mean, I knew I didn't want to go back there ever again. I also took that as an opportunity. I was there for a year and I didn't want to waste it. So I took every program they offered. I started going to AA in there, started going to church in there. I was a trustee and washed dirty laundry all day. I didn't want to sit there and rot. You know, you can, even though it's county jail and not prison, there's still criminal activity that goes on in there. If I wanted to sit there and get high that whole time and associate with people that aren't great, I could have chosen that path. And I didn't want to do that.
Now, how old were you when you went to prison?
When I went to jail, that would have been 31 now. So it would have been, I was 21.
So you get out of prison at 21, 22.
It would have been 22. I got out in 2017. February.
What was that like when you got out? Did you, what was the first thing you did?
Nothing. So you get released at midnight on your release date. It was February 2017 and my dad came to pick me up. As soon as I got sentenced, you know, I thought he was doing it not as a joke, but I don't think that he thought I was going to get sentenced to the year. As soon as I had court, I went back to the jail and I called him and I was like, look at what you did. Like, you put me here. And he's like, at least I don't have to watch you die. And the whole time that I was there that year, my dad's the only one that came to visit me every Monday. There wasn't a single person that came to visit me.
And mom's not in your life at all?
No, she was still not. And then I got released. My dad came to pick me up. And even though I felt like I did a lot of work in there, my mindset was, you know, I'm going to get out and I'm going to do good. You know, my dad just wasn't, it was almost like that time didn't even, I don't really know how to explain it. I got out and he was like, you still can't live with me. Like, he was like, figure your life out. Cause it was like, you know, I got out and it was right back where it left off almost.
So there was no, nothing available to you to help you transition from what you were doing to a better way of life.
Correct.
So yeah. For a period of some years after that, you went back to using.
Yes. So I got out and then right after that, not even maybe a week after I was out, I had a friend that originally lived in New York that I'd known for years. He got in trouble. He moved to Indiana. So he heard I got out of jail and he reached out to my dad and he's like, you know, I started a whole new life for myself. How about you send Heidi out here? And my dad just, his mindset sometimes is like, I know that he means well, but sometimes it's just like he just wanted me to be fixed. So that kind of seemed like a decent option, I guess, because right away he didn't even give me a choice. He called me and he's like, pack your bags. I bought you a plane ticket. You're going to Indiana. Figure out your life. Like, I don't want you here. So I was like, that's probably not going to work. I don't know.
So he was well-intentioned, but not really informed about what the possible options were. So you go to Indiana.
Yeah.
And you meet a friend there.
Yeah. I've known him for a long time. Like I said, we were party friends in New York. So, I mean.
And he was sober?
He told my dad he was.
And when you got there, he wasn't so sober.
No. First thing he did when I got off the plane was give me a bag of dope.
Great. Welcome to Indiana.
Yeah, it was.
Yep. And so the just got right on the mouse on the wheel.
Yeah, I was in Indiana for about 3 months, and I still don't really know how I made it through that time without dying. I don't, because that was a different ball game. The area that I was in,
shooting dope.
Yeah, the area Edinburgh is that's a very dangerous area. It's so normalized there. It's just bad stuff.
What happened after 3 months?
So I was there only for a few weeks and started using. I went there with no money. I went there with nothing but a bag of clothes. And my friend at that point in time, he had his own apartment. So I moved in with him, obviously. I tried walking down the road. I got a job at the Circle K gas station. And he ended up having a complete and total like mental breakdown. And he was like, I'm going back to New York. And he left me in Indiana. So, and then I couldn't keep the apartment. The landlord was like, he was months and months behind on rent. He was obviously using. So I moved out there and then kind of was left to fend on my own. So then I was on the streets.
On the streets for how long?
A couple weeks.
That must not have been very good.
No, that was like
anything you want to share about that time?
It's probably the most scared I've ever been in my life. Even though I've like gone through periods of obviously not making good choices, I've never been in an area like I'm not familiar with. I have no idea where anything is. I have no license. I have no car. I'm on foot. I know nobody out here. I have no money. It was just not a great feeling. I was always on my dad's phone plan, and he had my cell phone shut off for God knows how long. It was never on because it was like I didn't need it if he was paying for it, but I would keep it with me because I could use like the Wi-Fi. And so when I was on the streets, I was walking anywhere I can get Wi-Fi, ended up looking up where I can find a shelter. And I walked there and it's like first come, first serve. So they opened the doors from 6 to 9 at night and I didn't get a bed. And I was like not happy with this lady. I was like, listen, I am not from here. I cannot sleep outside. I had a whole meltdown and this gentleman, I'll like never forget him ever. He was waiting in line and heard what I was saying. And he's like, I'm not going to let you stay out here by yourself. Like, you're going to be all right and just stay with me. And I'm like, it's the only option I had. So I just went, and you know, if it wasn't for him, I don't know what I would have done. Cause he was kind of my means of survival. You know, he'd be like, oh, we can go to the hospital down here on the third floor. They got a water fountain upstairs. Like he would be like, stay here. And he'd leave and go get food and come back. He was like my only means of survival for the whole time that I was on the street until I was able to get off of them.
So that was for a few weeks.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so there came a time where you left Indiana.
Yes.
How'd you get where you were going?
June 7th, 2017. I was still using while I was on the streets of Indiana, obviously. The gentleman I was with somehow was magically pulling drugs out of wherever, but I was doing them. We ended up walking and we were staying under a bridge on 2nd Street in Columbus, Indiana. And I had my phone that, you know, was shut off in my backpack. And I remember we just did a shot. We were sitting under this bridge and I was like, I literally thought I was going to die out there. I had flip-flops on. My feet were blistered. I was in really bad shape. And I remember doing that shot, sitting under the bridge. He was sitting over there and just looking at the water and telling God that I was like, sorry. I was like, it's all right. Like, I take accountability for where I'm at and it's okay that I'm going to die here because I just didn't have any other options. I had reached out to my dad. He's like, I'm not bringing you back to New York for you to die in front of my face. Figure out your life. And as soon as I was under the bridge and just got done with like my thought and sitting there and evaluating my life, my phone rang and I was like, fuck, you know, because it was shut off. And I answer it. And it was this gentleman that used to work with my dad. And he was like, hey, kid, just checking in. I'm like, who the heck is this? And he went on to just explain, you know, he's known my dad for a long time. He knew me when I was younger and he's been sober for like 20 plus years. His name's Brad. And he just said, you know, your dad reached out to me and you're struggling. And all he asked me is like, I'm just going to ask you one time, do you want to fix your life? And I didn't really ask too many questions after that. I was like, I don't know what that means. And he said, just get on the plane. Where are you right now? I'll call a cab and just get on the plane.
And you got on the plane.
Sure did.
Yeah. Off to?
Wisconsin. I didn't know till I landed there where I was going, but I ended up in Wisconsin.
Now, we spoke a little bit about your meeting. It was almost like a God moment with this person calling you.
Yeah.
So you're evaluating the fact that you're going to die there. Mm-hmm. Out of nowhere, your dad's friend calls. You get on a plane. Mm-hmm. He arranges transit for you. Mm-hmm. And you go into a family that is kind of a normal place.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the best decision I probably could have ever made. And I still tried to convince myself that it was literally a miracle. I couldn't even really believe the phone call when I got it. And I remember telling Terry, the gentleman that was helping me on the streets, I looked at him. I'm like, you're never going to believe what is happening. Like, he's telling me he's going to put me on a plane. Like, I got to go. And I'm like, I'm not going. He's like, what do you mean you're not going? I was like, I am not going. He's like, yeah, you are. Because that stuff doesn't happen every day. And I remember it took everything in me. I had to get rid of all my contraband before I went into the airport. And I had one shoe, only one shoe. I probably smelled like a bag of rotten garbage. And I remember counting my steps on the plane. Like I did not, I knew it was what I needed to do. A part of me was like, go back under the bridge. It was hard. I won't ever forget looking at my feet and counting my steps on the plane. And then,
it must have been very, very frightening. You didn't know the guy.
Yeah, no. I just had to trust that I still knew in my gut it was better than dying under that bridge.
So Brad meets you at the plane.
Yep.
Get off the plane. Yep. What's that look like?
Oh my God, I was a hot mess.
What'd they do?
So he picks me up. He has his own, there's called like side by side. So he has his own like racing for recovery team is what it's called. So he has his own shop. He has his own side-by-side that he races. So he picked me up and he's like, you're going to come to the race with me. I'm fully aware that you're going to detox, but I want you to, you know, be with me. So
he's in recovery?
He's been clean for, over 20. He's 20, probably okay. 27 years now.
Okay. Yes. So he's trying to show you the way.
Yeah. Yep. So we end up, picks me up from the airport, gets me some food, brings me to his house first where I meet his wife and he has two stepkids, Gracie and Noah. They welcomed me in with like beyond open arms. And I went there at this point, I only had a pair of leggings and a t-shirt and my cell phone that was shut off. That's all I went there with. And they helped me. They bought me all new clothes. They helped me just, get myself together a little bit. I went to the off-road race with Brad in the trailer for a few days. And that's where I just started, you know, I was coming off of meth and everything else.
If you could give some advice to your young Heidi, based on all the things you've learned about life and about yourself, looking back, and let's say, I don't know if it's 10-year-old Heidi, maybe it's middle school Heidi, what kind of advice would you give them with the knowledge that you have right now?
Really simply, I think the biggest thing for me is to know that there's always good in the making, that better is coming. I struggled with that a lot. Is like, if you're in the pits, whether it's in relation to relapse or me sitting in jail or anything, sometimes it's so easy to stay stuck because you're like, you don't see better or think it's coming. And every single time I was in the pits of hell or in a really bad spot, something good came out of that. It's always serving a purpose and you totally have control of the outcome, you know, no matter what the situation that you're in.
So messages of kind of hope and faith.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Heidi, I'm really grateful for you spending time with us. Really proud and grateful that you came so far from so far away to come be with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
I want to ask everybody, if you could, please give us your comments, follow us, and smack that bell. And we want to know what you think. What are we doing that you like? What are we doing that you want more of? And really grateful for all our listeners. We're now crossed some path that the world says we're doing really good stuff. And it's because of you that are listening to us and watching us. So in that regard, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we'll see you next time on Crosstalk Podcasts.